Welcome to episode 128 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and Clea Simon joins me on the podcast to talk about World Enough, her new novel. The story, set in 2007, is triggered by events that took place during Boston's punk rock club scene of the mid-1980s. World Enough is Clea's 23rd mystery, but her first with a human protagonist and a non-feline storyline. For more information on Clea's many mystery series featuring cats in various roles, I encourage listeners to check out her website at CleaSimon.com. In the meantime, here's Clea Simon to talk about World Enough. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I am really delighted to be talking to Clea Simon, whose new mystery, World Enough, is about to be released on November 1st. Thanks for joining me, Clea.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as they say, timing is everything. You set World Enough, your new mystery, in 2007. Was that a function of wanting the events that set the story off to be 20 years in the past?
Well, actually, I have a two-part answer to that one, Nancy. To start with, yes, I wanted it to be 20 years after the event because I needed my protagonist to be of a certain age where she could look back and maybe just begin to wonder if her nostalgia was based in anything real. But also, 2007 was right when Boston, where this book is set, was booming, and it was sort of right before the crash. So there's a hint of that in there, too.
Yes, actually, you anticipate one of my later questions about the timing. But let's talk about Tara, who is, I think, a very interesting protagonist. And during the mid-80s, when the events that set the story in motion take place, she channeled her love of the music she was hearing, sort of the punk music scene, to cover this club scene for a fan magazine or zine. And in doing so, she discovered she was good at that. She was good at journalism, good at reporting and putting together stories. And fast forward 20 years, and the scene has sort of evaporated, and its participants, musicians, fans, and venues have grown up and gone away. Now she's in a corporate communications job and still longs to return. Can you expand on that and tell us why?
Yes, I hope I can. Tara always wanted to write. Even in the beginning, she's doing paste up at a newspaper, and she's sort of looking for her break. But yes, she develops her voice, and she learns really what she can do by covering these bands and writing about the scene, and she loves it. And that's when she's at her heyday. But as was true for so many of us, it didn't really pay, and she ended up, leveraging her zine writing into a job at an alternative weekly, and then moving on to a larger paper. But ultimately, you know, journalism doesn't pay as well as corporate jobs. So 20 years later, she's made some choices that she is now beginning to second guess. She's earning a little bit more money, but she's bored. And that's why when an editor approaches her and asks her if she wants to do a freelance piece, looking back on the club scene of World Enough, she's very tempted, and she says, well, you know, maybe I will. Just go back one more time.
And, of course, the story is told from Tara's point of view. And by, you know, what she tells the reader, she sounds like a completely reliable narrator. Except we learn that her memory is subjective. And as she works on this story that you mentioned about the scene, which was in the wake of the death of one of its prominent musicians, readers discover, and I think Tara also discovers, that maybe she was seeing things or remembering them through rose-colored glasses.
Well, isn't that true for all of us? Especially Tara is in her 40s, so she's looking back on her 20s as this golden period. But yes, as she begins to research it, she begins to uncover some truth that maybe she didn't know when she was younger, or maybe she just didn't want to know. So yes, as much as a discovery of the rock scene, this is a book about memory and about nostalgia and about maybe finally coming to terms with the truth that one didn't want to face when one was younger.
And also that sense of belonging that I think came in so strong, that one of the things that brought all the characters together, you know,
to sort of cross paths and set the things that the story is about in motion is that many of them were looking for a sense of belonging, and this club scene provided it. It provided a family.
Very much so. The club scene is the classic third place, neither home nor work, where people go just to meet and mingle. I don't really know if that happens these days because we have social media, but certainly back in the 80s we did. And, you know, people would go out to see bands, not even necessarily to hear specific bands, but just because sort of that was where the party was that night. That was where you knew your friends would be. And so you'd go out just to be out. And that fed on itself. So you had bands of friends and friends making bands. And also, musically, that was sort of a magical period because it was before the music industry, the bigger record label industry, really discovered how to market quote-unquote new music. So you had a lot of little labels and artists who were doing videos for their friends and people writing zines. So you had this whole creative community really doing what the punk community called DIY, do it yourself. And it was quite a family. But, you know, as we discover through the world of World Enough, families have dysfunctions too.
I'll say. And we touched on this earlier at the very beginning of our conversation, and that was 2007 was a very interesting time for Gen Xers. It's the year before the wheels came off the bus, economically speaking. You know, Boston was just booming. Everywhere was booming. You know, you had job offers. You were turning down 10 job offers a day, and I think that that's an interesting time because even 2 years later, even 2009, Tara might have been a little bit more concerned about her employment as she was her corporate employment as she was pursuing this freelance article about a time in her life that was 20 years in the past. I mean, am I reading too much into it, or is this a real thing?
No, you're reading it correctly. And also her ex, Peter, is urging her to buy a place and really sort of make a bigger financial commitment. And she's teetering on the edge. And of course, the dark side of all that, the booming economy, was the gentrification. At one point, Tara and one of her old friends, a musician named Phil, are looking at where one of their favorite clubs used to be, and now it's just a construction site. And that certainly happened all over Boston and in other cities as well, where the places that gave a city its character, that really sort of made cities distinct, were bulldozed over and turned into luxury condos and parking garages.
Yeah, I live in Los Angeles. I know the feeling.
Uh-huh.
and any character, and I just think it was a very complicated time because people didn't think about it as much. You know, they were dives. They were places that were maybe had licenses and maybe didn't, where these third places, as you described, and where people congregated to hear music and have fun and drink and do drugs.
Yeah.
This sort of permeated her life, and on reflection, you know, you were living in the time you didn't think these are the good old days. I'm going to look back on the ice on the sidewalks and the lack of bathroom facilities as the good old days. But in as of 2007, people kind of were.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's partly a function of being young, but when something is going on, you never think it's going to end. You just think it's been like this forever and it can just get better and all these bands are bound to be famous and we're all bound for something bigger and better. But then bigger and better comes and it means a boring corporate job or that your band just plays out on Sundays when your ex has the kids.
Exactly, because people have this tendency to grow up. You know, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about you and your career. You've written many books. Personally, I think categories of fiction are a mixed blessing. In an interview with me, Sophie Hanna said she appreciated them. She appreciated characters in that if she was looking for something specific, say a historical mystery or a thriller set in a particular city, she knew where to look. Up until now, you've been categorized as a writer of cozies, World Enough is described as noir. And I think once the veneer is peeled back on the Boston music scene, as you do in the mid-'80s, it's a deeply dark place, deserving of the title of the noir designation. What would you say the difference in how you approach the story from, say, one of your Dulcie Schwartz mysteries and Tara's story differs, or does it?
Well, that's a great question, but if I can walk back your question for a moment, all my previous mysteries, and World Enough is my 23rd mystery, and all my previous mysteries had cats in them, but they weren't all cozies. The Dulcie Schwartz mysteries and the Theda Krakow mysteries were very cozy, and the Dulcie ones in particular, I think, have a sweetness that I enjoy writing because they're nice places to spend time, shall we say. But some of my books, like my Prue Marlowe pet noirs, I use noir tongue-in-cheek there, are a little darker, and the Blackie and Kerr mysteries are really quite dark. My Blackie and Kerr mysteries, the series that starts with The Ninth Life, feature a homeless girl named Kerr and the feral black cat who has befriended her and who actually narrates the series. So they've all been cat mysteries, but they haven't all been cozies until now. But as you said about Sophie Hannah, I think what really intrigues me is character. And whether my characters are human or feline, they come alive for me. That's one of the joys of writing series, is that you don't have to ever, you know, finally say goodbye to a character because you know that character will come back. But yes, I like to think that I put a character in a situation, and then in the process of writing, I figure out what that character would do and ideally how that character would resolve that situation, though not always. World Enough is a lot darker, and I think there are many things unresolved. At the end of World Enough, the reader and Tara herself have a much clearer sense of what happened, both 20 years ago and the aftermath of those events in the present day of the book, the 2007 book. But it isn't the same idea that justice is done, so that's very different. But I think I started in the same way, of putting a character, dropping a character into a situation that becomes problematic and seeing what she will do.
You know, you bring up an interesting point of ambiguity, and I think it's something that distinguishes noir from, let's say, more cut-and-dried procedural fiction, especially procedural mysteries of the mid-century. The noir mysteries certainly were had characters who had a moral ambiguity, not you know, sort of Ed McBain. I don't think there was a lot of moral ambiguity with him, although people might argue with me. But certainly with Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald, the two patron saints of Southern California noir, there was so much moral ambiguity in the characters, both in the detectives and in the people that they were investigating. And I saw that with Tara. Especially at the end of the book. I don't want to introduce any spoilers, but once she discovers certain things about herself and about what she's investigating, she acts in an ambiguous way. She takes an ambiguous position.
Yes, the book ends, and thanks for noting that. The book does end sort of with a realization, and we're sort of left not sure exactly what Tara will do with all this information. And I kind of like that. There are hints of what she'll do, but the reader really has to put her or himself in that position and going, okay, now that I know this, what do I do with it? Because I want the reader to understand everything that happened, just as Tara does. And then I want the reader maybe to ask herself or himself, too, well, what would you do? What would you do if this happened and it was your community, your scene, and your friends?
So just by the answer to the one of the previous questions, I take it that you are more in the seat-of-the-pants school of writing rather than the outline from beginning to end school of writing.
Very much so, yes. I am what they call a pantser. I do have, I forget who it was who said that all you need is, it's like driving down a foggy road. You just have to see as far ahead as your headlights will allow you to. I do often have ideas about what will happen and even a sense of maybe how the central mystery will unfold. But, for example, the twist at the end of World Enough, I didn't realize until I was nearly done with the first draft. And then it hit me that this other big revelation was sort of an obvious thing. I was like, oh, my God, this happens. And I wrote that in. And then I thought, gee, I'm going to have to go back and retrofit all these clues now that I've come up with this. But as is sometimes the case, and this is the magic of writing, when I went back, I realized that the clues were there all along. It really was as if my characters knew more than I did about writing the book.
I think that's one of the most fascinating things about writing, is the life that the characters lead in the universe that the writers have created.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be one of the most difficult thing for readers who haven't done this to understand that you, as the writer, the creator of this character who's living in the universe that you created, will say and do things that on his or her own self. I mean, they'll take it upon themselves, and the writer might sit back and go, well, why did she do that? And I think that is so interesting. I really do.
It really is kind of magical. And people think that you're making that up when you say that. And yes, it is true. Those of us who are doing the typing can make our characters do anything. I could make Tara suddenly look over her shoulder and say, oh, I have sprouted wings and fly away. So it's not that I physically could not do that. It's just that when you've been living with a character for a while, there are some things that just don't feel right and some things that do feel right. So that's what we mean when we say a character wanted to do this. It's that you start to type something and you go, I can't, that voice doesn't sound right. She wouldn't put it that way. And then you realize that there's something that she would say. And a certain way she would say it. And that's when you go, ah, this is the way the character is leading me. So physically, yes, we have control over our characters. But when you get invested enough in their personalities and their patterns of speech and their patterns of behavior, then certain ways of writing them don't feel right. And you back away from that and you discover that what does feel right might be something different from what you had originally planned.
It's almost like a child. You might be able to make your child do something once or twice, but you're not going to be able to permanently make him or her do what you want. I say this from experience.
Exactly. That's it.
So you are a writer of series, and as you said, there are a lot of unanswered questions at the end of World Enough. Do you see Tara in a new mystery? Do you have Tara in a new mystery?
Well, I'm not working on one now, though this was conceived as a series. One of the possibilities that I'm considering, though of course I'll have to talk this over with my editor and my publisher, is setting another mystery in this milieu. Because I do have another mystery in mind that is set in the Boston rock scene, though it would really focus on a different character, a character who we haven't met in World Enough, but who will fit into the scene very well. And I see her story as being central to the next book. But first, I have some cozies to write, so I'm getting to retreat back into that gentler, kinder world first.
You know, before we sign off, I did want to talk about the title. You take this title from a poem, Renaissance era poem, I believe, isn't it?
It's Andrew Marvell. If we had world enough, but time, this coyness lady were no crime. It's basically that time is fleeting. And we have to make the most of our youth while we can. It's basically someone trying to seduce his girlfriend.
He's trying to seduce a woman and say, you know, we have to live in the moment. It's a carpe diem sort of feeling.
Yes. It's very much seize the day because we will not be young forever.
But what I found was interesting was you use this as the title World Enough, and you don't go into a lot of depth explaining it. And I actually liked that because it made me, I was familiar kind of vaguely World Enough in time, but it made me go back and look at the poem. and look at some of the interpretations of the poem. And I think whenever a writer is able to do that to a reader, that's a good thing.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, I did want to sort of load the book up with things. So friends of mine who were parts of the scene have read it, and generally they've been pretty wonderful about it and said that I captured something. Though, of course, all of them want to know which band I'm really writing about because they don't really want
the fiction. And who am I in the book?
Yeah, exactly. And I like to think also that people who don't know the scene and who maybe don't even care about rock music will enjoy it in the way that you enjoy any book sort of as a tourist. I mean, I don't live in Venice, but I love to read Donna Leon. So maybe, you know, this will be somebody who didn't go to the scene and wasn't part of it as a young person will be able to go, oh, that's what it was like.
Right. For those of us who were a little bit too old for this particular scene, like myself, and those who were too young and might look at it and go, oh yeah, you know, this is what it was like in the mid late 80s, early 90s. This is what grunge was like in Seattle, or this is what it was like to go see bands in Boston, Los Angeles, New York, you know, all of these places. It does look like the good old days.
The music was a common currency. It was something you could talk about and you could share, and you all touched base with each other over this, and that's where you built your community.
Exactly. Well, I, for one, would be curious to see and interested in reading another book in this set in this era. I think it's a fascinating time.
Well, thank you so much. I'll try to oblige.
Thank you again for your time and for talking about Tara and the world of music and in Boston in the mid-aughts. It was really an adventure to go with her.
Well, thank you so much for your interest in me and in my new mystery, World Enough. I really appreciate the time.